On this episode of Still Loading, women in classical video games. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this new episode of the Still Loading Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Koval, and today on the show, I have two wonderful guests with me, and we are discussing a book that they have worked on about a specific topic in gaming that really doesn't get spoken about, at least not in this niche of a format, or not a format, but in this niche of a topic. With me today are Drs. Jane Draycott and Kate Cook. How are you both doing today?
Very well, thank you.
Yeah, great, thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. The topic we are discussing is a book that you both worked on called Women in Classical Video Games. And I found this really interesting when I got contacted to speak with both of you. I found this incredibly interesting just because in general, when talking about women's portrayal in video games, it's usually a very broad topic. It kind of encompasses the entirety of the gaming sphere. And what your book is doing is it's narrowly focusing in on the portrayal of women in games that take place in classical antiquity, i.e. Assassin's Creed. In fact, looking at the list of essays and papers you have in here, some of these games I had never even heard of before. So it was kind of cool for me to look through this list, like Athena from 1986. Like, I had never even heard of that game, and that looks really cool. So it's covering a wide gamut of, you know, retro games to modern games and all over the place. And I'm very excited to talk to both of you about this. But before we dive into the book, just to tell the listeners a little bit about yourselves. What do you both do?
Shall I go first? Okay. I am a lecturer in ancient history at the University of Glasgow. I am a Roman historian. I tend to work on health, well-being, medicine, disability in antiquity. And I do a few things on the side, as most academics tend to do. And one of those things is looking at the reception of antiquity in different areas, in this case, video games.
And listeners, just to put a name to the voice, that is Jane speaking. And then obviously next up here is Kate. So Kate, talk a bit more about yourself.
Yes, so I'm an associate lecturer at the moment at the University of St Andrews. So we're in fact both now based in Scotland, in the UK. And I am a specialist in two main areas, one of which is Greek literature, specifically Greek drama. I'm mostly interested in gender in Greek drama, so I have kind of strong focus on research on gender, which obviously we brought to this book. And my other main area is probably now reception in classical and broader historical video games as well.
And I should just add actually that Scotland is probably the best place in the UK to do anything in relation to video games, not just academic research, but the games industry itself.
Are there actually, I actually don't even know how many different developers over there, like who's over in Scotland that's not even of note, but just in general?
We have Rockstar North in Edinburgh. We have
Noco, probably should have known that.
Blazing Griffin. There are a bunch of developers in Dundee because of the university there. Abbotay does a world-renowned set of games courses. So, yeah, in Scotland, it's quite a big industry.
So, to talk about the book specifically now, like I said before, the name of the book is called Women in Classical Video Games, and you both are the editors for this book. So I kind of want, the first question I wanted to ask about it specifically is, what was the inspiration for it? Like I said before, this is a very niche topic within the realm of the overall discussion of women's portrayal in video games. So what kind of led you to talking about this specific niche version of that topic?
Well, the reception of classical antiquity in video games is itself quite a new and quite a niche topic within classics and ancient history and archaeology. And there's really only a sort of handful of people who have published on this topic broadly. You can fit them all into one footnote. And a couple of years ago, there was an edited volume published that was, I think, the first one, certainly in English anyway, about classical antiquity in video games. And I was asked to review this this volume, and I did, and it was great. But of the roundabout 20 or so contributors to that volume, only, I think, two of them were women, and only one of the chapters actually looked at anything to do with women. And this was something that I mentioned in the review, that it was a shame that this was so limited, that it was inadvertently perpetuating these stereotypes of gaming being for boys, for men, games being all about men and male stuff. And of course, that's not so much the case these days. And in fact, the chapter in the book was about how female characters are sort of overly sexualized and treated appallingly. So if that was the only female representation in that volume, then it didn't necessarily provide a positive view of the topic. It didn't provide encouragement. So yeah, I commented on this in the review, and then the editors of the series that this volume appeared in contacted me and said, well, okay, would you like to do something about this? And I thought about it for a little while, and I thought maybe I did. And then Kate and I were strolling around the streets of Paris, as you do, and we were talking about video games. You know, Kate's an avid gamer, and obviously also a classicist. She works on quite different stuff to me. So we wouldn't otherwise get a chance to do anything together. So we thought we'd do this.
Kate. That's cool.
Yeah, and I think for both of us, it was really quite important to do this sort of soon as well, because as Jane was saying, this is quite a new field, the idea of looking at what we would call classics, but kind of the whole ancient world in video games. Is there's still only, you know, one or two books. This is probably the third book wholly dedicated to this topic in the entire academic discipline. And what we didn't want was for us to kind of wait 20 years and then someone to say, oh yeah, now shall we do women? We really felt like we had this opportunity to jump in while the field was brand new and while it was developing, and say, here is this really important topic. Let's do it at the beginning of the field. Let's not leave it as an afterthought. Let's not kind of leave female characters and kind of these gender issues until later. Let's get them in while the field is developing and really draw attention to how important this issue is kind of straight away. So it was important to us, once we'd kind of had this idea and noticed this gap, to do it speedily, I think.
I think that's a very good idea, not just because of the topic. Well, actually, no, specifically because of the topic itself, because I find a lot of the times when you see people trying to shed light on issue on areas that are criminally underlooked at, or not looking at in enough depth. It kind of becomes like, well, this is the norm now. And then when you try to change the norm, that's when people start pushing back. And you see this, unfortunately, with a lot of the culture wars between, you know, different political sides. And we're not going to go and get into that. But whenever you try to change that norm, that's when a lot of those divides come in. So if you're setting the norm from the outset, like when you're looking into it right from the very get-go, that's the norm. There's not going to be, hopefully, not going to be a whole bunch of blowback just because you're trying to investigate something that has not been investigated, or at least looked into it nearly much as it should have. So looking through this book, I'm just incredibly fascinated by all the different essays and would you call them essays or papers or both? Are they interchangeable? Is that term interchangeable?
Yeah. Or chapters, any of those chapters. I think would be fine. Yeah.
Okay. So all the different chapters of the book. And my next question is, how did you go about kind of curating this list? Was it something where you sought people out, or was it something more the long lines like you put out a calling, like a calling and saying, hey, if you're interested in this, please submit a paper to us? Or how did this whole process go about?
Well, it was a little bit of both of those things, because it's such a small field that we knew that there were people. So Dunstan Lowe, for example, he's one of the few people who has actually published on classical video games. So we knew we wanted him to be in the volume, so we approached him specifically. But as far as the rest of the volume was concerned, we put together a call, an open call for papers, because we thought, rather than have a conference, because when as great as conferences are, they do add a lot of extra time in and work for everybody into the equation. And what because we wanted to do this quite quickly, and we wanted to strike while the iron was hot with a lot of the games as well, we basically just issued the call straight away and said, if you would like to be part of this volume, send us an abstract. And then we got so many abstracts. We got about 50 abstracts. And of course, you can't have anywhere near 50 papers in an edited volume. You can generally have about a dozen, 15, something like that. So you do curate out of all of the responses you get. And then we ask people to write their papers, send them to us. We then had them, we reviewed them ourselves. We then had them peer reviewed as well. And yeah, we were able to put the volume together, turn it around in 2 years. I think we sent out, sent out the initial call for papers in the spring of 2020. And yeah, it's just been published now. And I think we were helped a little bit by the global pandemic, because people were at home and were playing a lot of video games, and people wanted escapism. So there was it was something that I think our contributors quite appreciated. And we also, because of, again, this kind of new emerging nature of this area of research, the vast majority of the contributors are early career researchers, PhD students, newly vibed PhDs and postdocs. So they were all very keen to get a publication, get something out there. And we've had some nice emails from some of our contributors saying how great it is to see their names in print and to have this lovely book on their shelf. So that's very gratifying as well.
Yeah. And again, I think doing it as an open call was quite kind of important to us as well, because as we were introducing this new field, we really wanted it to be a decent range of different types of people. So if we just asked people we know, that might have limited the field. Whereas as it is, you know, we were able to take some of our contributors are not academics at all. So we've got, you know, games writers from journalism and so on contributing as well. And that was because they had seen the call and they were able to respond. And we had a chance to kind of really think about the range of types of contributors we could have through this sort of quite open process. Because as Jane said, we got an awful lot of submissions. So the interest was clearly absolutely there. People were really keen to write things, so we were, you know, fortunately for us, very able to be kind of selective and really think about how to get the best mix of contributions, which was really great.
And it's also good in relation to the coverage of the games themselves. I mean, we knew we had to cover Assassin's Creed, because that is the big one, really. I suppose Total War, for example, is another very influential video game. Probably that the previous generation of people working, the older academics such as ourselves who are working in this area, most of us probably did get inspired by Total War and games of that time. Whereas the academics, the young academics that are coming through now, are probably more so it's Assassin's Creed. But we didn't just want the whole volume to be about Total War, because that gets quite a lot of coverage already. And Assassin's Creed also gets quite a lot of coverage. Mm-hmm. We wanted other games, other perspectives, stuff that wasn't entirely obvious. And independent developers, mobile developers, because video games are not just AAA. There's a whole lot of other stuff, really, in under the umbrella term video games.
Now, like you said, you had 50-ish submissions, and then you had to whittle that down to, you actually did whittle it down, excuse me, to 15 essays or 15 total chapters. And so my next question is to kind of talk a little bit about the essays you chose. I guess, how would you describe the overall, what the overall intention of the book is? Like, what is the message you're trying to get out? Because obviously you had to, if you take 50 different essays and whittle it down to 15, you're using some sort of methodology that fits into the narrative, may not be the right term, but maybe it's the best description that I can think of, but like the narrative you're trying to go for this. So like, what was your methodology and what was the overall narrative that you're trying to fit all of these essays in to like make the point you're trying to make?
Well, initially, when we issued the call for papers, it was very broad. It was historical, archaeological, so any period, really. I mean, because we were both working on the sort of the classical ancient world, we were expecting quite a few of those, and we got quite a few of those. But we also got quite a lot of papers from other periods of history, other civilizations. And there is actually a second volume, it's the first one, actually. It came out first. There is Women in Historical and Archaeological Video Games, which is edited by me and published by De Gruyter in their Games in the Humanities series. And so in that volume, because the 50 contributions, they broadly split sort of 25 or so on classical stuff and 25 or so on non-classical stuff. And so we were able to sort of separate out refine both of those areas to have two volumes with two very strong sets of papers. So I won't really talk about the other volume so much now, because we're talking about the classical one. When it came to the classical content, I suppose the first thing that you do is you look for duplication. And we did have, because of course we had a lot of papers about Assassin's Creed. So some of those were covering roughly the same material. So we sort of chose the ones out of that we thought had the sort of more cohesive or stronger arguments. And as far as sort of themes were concerned, we would, if we had sort of duplicating themes, we would do the same sort of thing. We would look for the argument that seemed like it would stand up more independently. We also wanted to get quite a broad range of games in as well. So we were sort of very keen to not have two or three chapters on one, say God of War, for example.
Yeah.
Obviously, there are lots of different God of War games, but at the same time, we didn't necessarily want to devote a whole lot of space to God of War or to Assassin's Creed or to Total War at the expense of other smaller, lesser known games. So we wanted to try and make sure that we were getting lots of variety, really, and I suppose up to date stuff as well. Things that games that have really only just come out, so things like Hades, these new games, these chapters on these new games are possibly the first scholarship actually even published on some of these games. So yeah. that was also something that we were thinking about.
Yeah, a range of games, absolutely. But I think also we were quite interested in trying to aim for a range of topics as well, because again, when you see kind of scholarship on women in games, there's a kind of few key themes that tend to come up. So, sexualization and sexuality is often one of them. And we thought, that good, we would like a chapter on that, but we didn't want the whole volume to start drifting into kind of the same types of representation. It was important to us if we could to try and shine a light on all the different ways. I mean, you know, you can't do all of them, but as many different ways as possible that games were representing women, and as many kind of different types of women as we could as well. So, you know, we've got women of all kinds of different statuses. We've got supernatural women in there. It was kind of range and variety was quite important to us, because if this is going to be a starting point, then again, you know, we'd like it to be a starting point that encourages people to go off in a lot of different directions and doesn't sort of narrow down the field to just this way of looking at women in games. So yeah. range in both areas, both in kind of the themes and topics and in the games selected, I think was really important to us.
It actually, we did have quite a lot of discussions between ourselves about when we were thinking about women in classical video games, what were we actually thinking about? Do goddesses count as women? Because they're supernatural creatures, they're divine beings, they're not, or are they women in the sense of your sort of everyday, ordinary, historical or sort of semi-historical figure? So we did, but of course, when it comes to classical video games, if you were to say, we don't want to include the goddesses, we only want to include the real women, you are cutting out quite a sizable amount of female representation. Because mm-hmm. when it comes to classical video games, you, in some respects, are quite limited with the female characters that you've got to work with. Mm. Whereas in other historical periods, perhaps not so much. But because when it comes to games set in classical antiquity, a lot of them are very military in nature, and consequently, they don't have a whole lot of female characters, or at least female characters with the sort of agency, playability, story, etc., to work with.
So I have a friend named Pat who is actually going for his PhD in medieval history, and he's going to be really, he kind of studies all, I think he was really interested in Roman history for quite some time, so he might be a little disappointed with me by this question, but like when the way that the women who are gods, whether it's Aphrodite or I can't even list a bunch because this is something I'm not well versed in, like just the mythology and the worlds around them, is there the fact that they are women a very defining attribute about them, or like do they kind of play into the stereotypes of what women, how women were represented back in that time, or was it more because they were a god, does their godhood supplant the fact that, like, does that make sense?
It does make sense as a question. It tends to vary quite a lot. So kind of in the kind of classical mythology, there are some for whom, so Aphrodite is in many ways quite a female stereotype in quite a few of the texts mm-hmm. and things that she appears in a way that someone like Athena, who is a goddess of warfare, is how kind of femininity is often in texts played down quite a lot. But of course, when we look at games, there's a kind of another element here as well, which is the kind of stereotyping that games designers do. And so one of our contributors looked at kind of sexualization of Aphrodite in the God of War games, for example, and points I think really effectively to some of the ways in which the kind of the portrayal of Aphrodite in these games is tapping into stereotypes surrounding games and women. So they've kind of almost made Aphrodite even more stereotypically female through the game making process than you would necessarily find in the kind of classical mythology. So I think there's quite an interesting crossover of attitudes in this area.
Yes, I mean, one of the things that we had to bear in mind was generally video games are not made by academics.
Mm-hmm.
And while some game developers like to make a point about how much research they have done or how they have used historical consultants and things like that, ultimately what they're doing is still presenting something that people want to play. It's entertainment rather than mm-hmm. education. Or if it's education, or if there's an educational element in it, it can't really be too challenging. So when it comes to the historical content of games, you have to bear in mind that they're perhaps projecting the idea that people have about the historical period or the historical society, the sort of familiar, comforting idea rather than the
what's
the
historically more, accurate.
Yeah, yeah. It's the difference between historical accuracy and historical authenticity. And at one point, I thought those two things were the same. You know, accuracy and authenticity, I thought, they're basically the same thing. But when it comes to looking at these aspects of video game creation, authenticity is not about being historically authentic in relation to how it was. It's about what people think it was. So nothing happens that suspends their disbelief and ruins their gaming experience. And that is a whole other, when it comes to that, that's generally an issue with historical video games. But when it comes to the presentation of women in these historical video games, it's a whole other level, really, oh dear.
Figure like Aphrodite, you know, the sexualization gets really played up because that's really what, you know, gaming audiences expect, is a kind of very feminized, very sexualized version of Aphrodite. So there is some of that in the classical text, and then it really gets out of control once it gets into a game.
I feel like a lot of people, their perception of what history was is based off the media they consume. So referencing my friend Pat before, he was mentioning that a lot of academics and historians are really looking at how media portrays historical events, because our perception of those events, or just time periods, whether it's talking about a specific event or just a culture within a specific era, are heavily skewed by what the media we intake. So it makes it's good to kind of thoroughly investigate these types of things and kind of call out the things that are accurate and inaccurate. Now, my question is, do you think that historical accuracy will actually ruin the immersion of a game? Like, I understand that some game developers have changed stuff, but I can't think of I get why they over-sexualize female characters. Not saying it's okay, but I understand, like, that's been the norm for so long. But if they get rid of that and they just make it as authentic as possible, I don't really feel like that would ruin the game. But have you ever noticed any examples, or can you think of something where it would, like the authenticity would ruin a game? Other than like physical things, like obviously you have the supernatural human abilities of people running and jumping across buildings and stuff.
But. Yeah, sure. So I think, you know, that side of things, the gameplay mechanics and so on is, although it's kind of easy to say, well, we definitely need to change those. I mean, you probably do need to change those. If you're going to have a landscape like, you know, in Assassin's Creed Odyssey, you're going to have classical Greek and you're going to make the player spend as long as it takes to travel across Greece. That's just not enjoyable.
Yeah,
so
no,
there are kind of
some
practical aspects.
Yeah,
which just won't work. I mean, I personally think no. And I think actually medieval studies is an area where that some really interesting work is being done here, with kind of very well researched, very kind of detailed games on specific aspects of medieval history that, you know, like there was a game on kind of manuscript production a little while ago, which is really quite specialized, but fantastically interesting as a little kind of, it's only a little thing, but it's really enjoyable. And I'm aware of kind of other developers doing some very historical work on kind of the effect of the plagues in some places, by which I don't mean Plague Tale, although that is quite well researched. There are kind of even more academic projects. And so I think, you know, there is scope for very detailed historical work to be done and to put into games and to provide real points of interest and real points of difference. The problem, I suppose, is that I can see how it would take quite a lot more time and energy and sort of specialized skills. So I think, you know, from a game element, I think historical games could be better if there was more accuracy, more desire to kind of research all these details and kind of push these subjects in very different areas into more specialized, almost niche areas. It could give us a lot more variety and a lot of exciting things to look at. I'm just not sure whether, you know, that amount of money and time and developer energy is necessarily going to go into that. And that would be, you know, the knock-on impacts for the process, I suppose we could say, would actually be a potential drawback for developers and development companies if they're having to spend like a year doing specialized research first in order to produce these very detailed games that I'm thinking about, then maybe, you know, that is a problem. But But personally, I think it can only add to the situation.
I have a slightly different view, which is not necessarily a practical one, but I just find it incredibly depressing how creatively stagnant so many producers of supposed entertainment are, and the arguments that they use to supposedly justify their creative stagnation. So I'll use an example that's not from video games, but if you think about Game of Thrones and mm-hmm. House of the Dragon, and even the Lord of the Rings, Rings of Power, I mean, I'm going to use these because they're sort of happening now and there's been a lot of discussion about them.
Yeah.
The arguments that are used in support of things like the horrible treatment of women in Game of Thrones and House of the Dragon is that's how it was in history. And that may or may not be true, but the fact is that neither of these TV shows are set in historical reality.
They are fictional worlds.
They are fantasy worlds and fantasy civilizations and fantasy cultures. And they may well have been inspired by the Wars of the Roses or whatever else George R.R. Martin thought was interesting. But that is not what they are supposedly depicting for us on screen. And there's an author who has written a really great sort of medieval inspired fantasy, Samantha Shannon, and her novel is The Priory of the Orange Tree. And she uses a whole lot of different medieval Renaissance world history and cultures to inform her world in this mm-hmm. novel. And she has said very emphatically, there is no sexual assault in this universe, because if she is creating a fantasy world and she can put anything she likes in this fantasy world, why on earth would she include that? There's just no need for it. And yeah. I sort of feel when it comes to video games that this is quite a sort of pertinent point, because if you can create anything you want, any world you want, any story you want, why do you just want to rehash the same old stuff and do it in exactly the same old way that so many other developers have done before, when you could do something different? It doesn't have to be completely 100% brand new, but there are things that you could do that would be, you know, a bit more interesting than the same old depictions of the Greek gods, the Greek goddesses, the way they talk, the way they dress. You know, we have seen it in films and TV shows and other video games. So why not do the thing that you're meant to be doing, which is be creative and be imaginative? And I can appreciate that they can't be too creative and too imaginative, because there are, you know, things like money and sales and other things at play. But it just seems to me to be so hackneyed, really, to just keep regurgitating the same fairly stereotypical stuff.
That makes me think of something I really hadn't thought of before. So when I was first heard about your book and just thinking about, you know, the portrayal of women in video games set in classical antiquity, and I was thinking a lot of it was talking about like, okay, you're going to look into obviously the historical accuracy of video games, also highlighting the sexism that is portrayed in video games. But one thing I never really thought about is that our perceptions of history is just, and whether it's intentional or not, it's another way to kind of mask misogyny, if that makes sense. Like, I had never really thought, because if we are under the perception, under the assumption that women are just treated like crap in, you know, ancient, in medieval Europe and in ancient Rome, and I'm I don't know enough about it. I'm sure that it's a lot worse than it was now, but maybe it's not as bad as we perceive it to be. If it is, and feel free to correct me after this, but if we're using that as just a justification, like this takes place in medieval Europe or this has that same type of vibe, then it's a full write-off to be like, well, I can just treat women like shit in this because that's my perception of history. Therefore, I'm being historically accurate. And while there is some level of accuracy probably there, it might not even be intentional. They might not even be intentionally being like misogynistic, but that's kind of what's the coming about from. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And this is something that we saw actually particularly, this is something which I've looked into a depressing amount, but when we were looking at kind of player responses to women in both historical and interestingly mythological video games. So our fantastic cover image is Penthesilea from the Amazons from Total War Troy, which is kind of deliberately set in this heroic age, which probably doesn't really exist. I mean, there are some, you know, there is some historical background to some of the Trojan War, but certainly most of it from the Iliad, which is what this game really draws on, is not meant to be sort of taken literally as a historical account at all.
Yeah.
And there were still nonetheless players saying, you know, this portrayal of the Amazons is not historically accurate because women would never be allowed to be leaders, and you would never be allowed to have all women soldiers. And you think, well, I mean, that's what the Amazons were supposed to be mythologically. And even when you get, you know, genuine historical examples of kind of leader figures. So in some of the Civilization games, for example, they recently introduced Gorgo as a kind of Spartan leader for Greece. And you know, she's an influential figure. She's not, you know, queen of all Sparta forever ruling everything, but she's nonetheless, she is an existing historical figure. And nonetheless, there was quite a lot of pushback about this idea because, again, people think, well, that because of my understanding of what these societies were like, and also sometimes my desire to see these societies in this particular way, I do not believe this is historically accurate, even though often this is more kind of historically accurate or even mythologically accurate, in which case we're not talking about history at all. We're just using this as a kind of cover for attitudes to how women should, with massive air quotes around should, be represented in these settings.
That's just, I had never really thought about it that way, where it's our perception is so skewed to like, this is what our, and it's weird. It's a weird level of arrogance to be like, well, this isn't what I have never studied history, but this is how women are portrayed. Or take out if anyone who's getting like super sensitive about this for whatever reason, take out the fact, just the historical accuracy in regards to women, take any historical accuracy, if your perception is like this is historically accurate without you actually taking the time to study it, then is it? Like, do you have papers to back it up? Do you have your research to back it up? Can you provide links to articles and papers and whatnot to be like, yeah, no, this is correct. My perception is correct because I've done all this research. If you have, then, you know, awesome. But I'm fairly certain 99%, I'm not going to guesstimate on a percentage, but the majority of gamers don't do that. And that's not even necessarily a slight against them, but if you're not in the field, why would you? But it's a weird level of arrogance to be like, well, I know this is true, even though I haven't researched it. And I know it's true because I've played a video game based on it. That's fascinating. I never would have, I don't know, that just, that was a cool realization for me.
I mean, it's worth saying, in the kind of wider historical game studies, people, I mean, since Adam Chapman, really, but this is kind of a common growing theme. People, scholars of history, keep reminding us that also the sort of suggestion that gamers should go away and sort of do their research assumes there is kind of one correct history anyway, which is also nonsense. You know, even if they go away and do their research, the things they're researching will be framed by particular biases and the kinds of stories that have been told. So someone like a female kind of influential figure like Gorgo is not mentioned very much in male-authored Athenian sources. That doesn't mean she doesn't exist. Even if you go and do the research, there are things behind all of these accounts that even the kind of ancient sources themselves, in this case, will shape the kind of story you get. So you've got one kind of story or narrative, which we could call history with air quotes around it, and you've got another kind of narrative with these games in, and whether there's no sort of one correct one, but people will like to make claims for correctness because it's the story they like or they know or they want to see, very commonly.
Confirmation bias, essentially.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's also highly selective, even in relation to women. So, you know, the sort of the idea of, well, okay, I will accept female characters in my historical video game, even though they wouldn't have been there really, but they must be gorgeous. They must be sexy. They must have perfect teeth and be wearing clothing that is suitably sort of titillating. If they're soldiers, they must be wearing, you know, boob armor that's providing no real protection. They're not going to be historically accurate women who look like historically accurate women. You know, if you use bioarchaeological evidence for information about people's health and hygiene and their teeth and other things, you know, they're not going to look like the sorts of Victoria's Secret models that you often seem to find strolling through the ancient settings.
But even with that in mind, not to diminish the amount of sexism in video game industry, but it's the same with male characters as well. Like, there's how many guys out there look like Kratos? You know what I mean? Or how many, like every dude is some buff guy or some handsome dude like Nathan Drake from Uncharted. I love the Uncharted games. That's not a diss at Uncharted, but it's the same for everybody. Like they and that's unfortunately just the marketing and media. You want to look at quote unquote attractive people because that's what sells more. But not
how
that's
often
not
does Nathan Drake anything, do his missions with his shirt off, you know, that's he's allowed to do other things apart from be sexually objectified for the player.
And that's where obviously a lot of the portrayal of women are in video games, where it's hopefully changing. I'd like to think it is, but it also is me coming from a male perspective. But like a lot of times, as you said, like women's sole purpose in games is to be objectified versus having agency. And and in the past couple of years, you've seen more. Like like one of the most popular action games of a couple of years ago was Horizon Zero Dawn. And while Aloy is an attractive character, I mean, if in your opinion, would you feel she's overly sexualized? I don't, but once again, I'm a guy, so I'm not going to put my opinion in on that.
Not at all, actually. I love Horizon Zero Dawn, and I'm currently playing Forbidden West, and I love those games. In part, I think because Aloy is such a great character, and she's got such a rich world that she is wandering around in.
Mm-hmm.
And there is classical stuff in the games, but you know,
that's a fictional world too. Well, sort of. Well, it's fictional, but it's like an imagined world in the future after we've already killed the environment and it's taken back over. Sorry, you were going to say something, Kate?
Yeah, I was just going to say, again, there's a kind of funny aspect of player expectations and what players will allow here, though, because I don't know if either of you seen, but there was a while ago these images circulating of her kind of glammed up more to suit what fans wanted from a female protagonist, which is...
Yes, because there is those screenshots, those unflattering screenshots of Aloy at like a weird angle, so her face looked a little bit fuller, and it's like... I don't know what to tell you. Like, you know, the devs are going to make her look quote unquote good looking at some way, because that's just what sells. But it was weird that they it was just a weird phenomena. People just got really upset over absolutely nothing.
Yes.
Well, this is something that's happened with other games. So Hellblade, Senua's Sacrifice.
I have not played that yet. I've heard nothing but good things.
Well, in creating the character to be a believable warrior woman, the developers actually looked at athletes' bodies in order to create a physique that looked like it could realistically, feasibly be wielding a great big sword.
Mm-hmm.
And they got pushback because she was too butch. She was too muscly, too masculine. She wasn't sexy enough. And that game, it's all about her trauma and her mental illness and her
why does sexiness have to come into that into
exactly.
play at all?
There's no need for sexiness there. That's not really what she's concerned about. Sort of rescuing her lover from a hellish afterlife. She's not really concerned about, you know, being sexy. And it's just sad that is all of the amazing things that you can do with a female character, a female avatar in an imaginary video game world, but there must also be sexiness as well. And it's just depressing, really, that is still seen to be so necessary for the character to be believable, enjoyable, appreciated.
Yeah, and I think, Josh, you're right that, you know, this is changing, but I'm not sure it's changing enough. I mean, we've mentioned the Amazons mm-hmm. and people's expectations for them already, and one of the commentators we looked at did say that they thought the Amazons should fight with a bit less armor on so that they would be more, and I quote, tastefully sexy. This would be better. And that game is, what, 2 years old?
Tastefully sexy sounds like a ridiculous band name.
I know, but that's what the commentator wants, apparently, from these Amazons. They've got to be tastefully sexy if they're going to be in the game.
Just tastefully. I want to create a band now. That was my high school band's name. I'm going to retcon my own history. That was my high school band's name. Tastefully sexy. Anyway, some of the other questions I had going on, though, without spoiling too much about the book, because we've been kind of talking kind of nebulously about the topic of just women's portrayal in video games. So now, in regards to the book specifically, what were some of the findings that are kind of gone into through the essays? Like, I obviously don't spoil the whole book, you wouldn't be able to in the amount of time we have, but just some quick highlights. What are some interesting points or findings that were made throughout the journey of this book?
One of the questions that we asked ourselves in the introduction, both looking forward to the volume as a whole, but also reflecting on the volume, because of course we had read all the chapters and we knew what they were going to say before the person opening the volume and reading it did. We did ask ourselves, is it actually possible to have a positive portrayal of a female character in a video game set in the classical world? Because a lot of the chapters didn't necessarily matter what their specific game they were looking at was, or what their specific theme or topic was. They did draw out the fact that a lot of the portrayals are quite negative, or what, mm-hmm. what we would view of as negative, as opposed to tastefully sexy or you know, any
my band, else. Of course.
But, you know, we would say these are not positive. They are not historically accurate, or they are not particularly gratifying to a 21st century female
mindset, yeah.
or possibly male player. And so that is one thing that was interesting to see. This sort of, in the main,
it's a heavy question to ask yourself for this.
Yeah, because of course we, you know, then you sort of go down the rabbit hole of, well, are any of these games worth playing? Should we as classicists and ancient historians, should we just, you know, eschew them altogether because they're just, you know, all kinds of wrong? But and I will throw this over to Kate specifically about her chapter, because there are places where the portrayals are perhaps more positive, and these are not places that you would necessarily first think of when it comes to video games.
Yes, so thanks. That's a nice kind of trailer for me and my chapter. Yeah, so I think, I mean, this ties into what I would say is one of my main findings, actually, is we've talked quite a lot already about the value of range for us. And I think the chapters and the kind of book as a whole really emphasizes that, because if you look beyond the kind of AAA games, the big, and also the kind of games that people often think of as historical games, so the strategy games and the action games and so on, and you look into different genres of game, you start to see some very different things happening. So we had a couple of chapters on indie games that were kind of significantly more positive in models of female agency. Hades was kind of a nice example of showing a female character with a deliberately improved level of agency in comparison to kind of other works looking at this character. But then for my own chapter, I looked at a mobile game. And, you know, when we say video games, a lot of people do not think of mobile games at all. They don't.
Very true.
They don't count them. A lot of the, you know, the journalism, mm-hmm. the scholarship. I don't know how much you do on video on mobile games. So this is, you know,
none,
not a criticism
but that,
at all.
There's still
but
games.
But yeah, you see,
yeah.
Like, people often don't. And mobile gaming is the fastest growing sector of video games. It's mm-hmm. got an enormous number of kind of players and interest. And it also tends to attract quite different groups of players because you don't need anything for it. You don't need a gaming PC or to buy a PlayStation or a Nintendo Switch or whatever. You just, nearly everyone has got a smartphone. And so the kind of range of players it attracts can be very different. And that means often these games are aiming for very different things. And so I looked at this mobile game, which has kind of as part of its wider umbrella, it's not all historically focused, but as part of its wider group, it has a story set in the end of the Republic in Rome. And because they expect their audience to be mostly young women, because of the type of game that this is an interactive romance stories game, so they expect their audience to be mostly young women, their main characters are nearly always female, and they really emphasize the importance of female agency as part of the gameplay because they know their players won't enjoy it if they go for some kind of, you know, overly sexist interpretation of gender. Mm-hmm. They know that their audience is going to push back against that. So they have a really different and a really quite refreshing view of how to look at questions of historical gender in what is therefore, despite, you know, being another type of video game, despite, you know, it becomes of quite a different context effectively.
Yeah.
So I think the value of remembering all these different genres, and not just kind of different genres within console and PC games, but also pushing out to mobile games, was really brought home to me by doing this study, because I think if we don't, we can miss out on things going on elsewhere that actually could be quite important for showing us different models of thinking about, I mean, in this case, issues of gender, but all sorts of kind of issues of representation in gaming.
My friend Pat that I mentioned before, I actually texted him right before we recorded because I wanted to double check what degree he was going for with his history, but he brought up a very good question I think is kind of applicable to this kind of topic we're on right now. For games that are going to be coming out, I know this is your both of yours impersonal interpretations and personal opinions on it, but how would you like to see women portrayed in games that take place in classical settings? Would you want to see it more accurate, or would you like to see a more modern view of feminism and women and kind of apply it, like apply that character to a classical setting? Like, would you want to be more accurate, or is it accurate? Is there some cross ground? Is there some common ground between the two?
So I keep getting asked this question because I've been doing quite a lot of talking about gender and historical games recently. So I'll jump in and give Jane slightly longer to think about, because it's a hard question. But my kind of slight cop-out answer is, I think actually the best way to tackle this would be wider variety of all types of representation. Because if you only, you know, if women are protagonists in one in every 50 games, and the rest of the time we just have kind of one model of representation, that is very dissatisfying. But if we are having a huge range of variety, so that would allow for some games to be very historically accurate in their portrayal of women, but also some, you know, a wider variety of feminist games as well. If we had different models of masculinity as well in the kind kinds of, you know, heroes that you get, which is very often, you know, action hero focused. Mm-hmm. If we were seeing different models of that as in terms of who could be the hero of a video game, I think this would really open up a lot of possibilities. And so it wouldn't really necessarily matter if there was one game that kind of had quite a limited portrayal, because there would be another 50 games alongside them that were doing different things and that were asking different questions and engaging with these issues of gender in all different ways. I don't think that everyone has to design games the way I want them to, but but more engagement across the board, more thinking about these questions in all different ways would, I think, be a real positive and would allow for a much better, kind of more fulfilling exploration of these issues in both directions. So some more historically accurate and some more historically wildly inaccurate is my answer. I want more of everything.
I suppose I would, as from an academic perspective, I guess I would concur with that, because that gives us a whole lot more to actually talk about. So I suppose what I would like as a gamer playing a game set in some kind of ancient setting, classical perhaps, I guess I just want a very three-dimensional, rich world to wander around in. And it doesn't have to be particularly feminist or politically correct or 21st century or anything else, but I want there to be a variety of things for me to do that are suitably interesting, not 100% combat, not 100% strategy, but I want to be able to pick things up and put them down and sell them and craft them. And if those things are suitably historical, then great.
Kind of like a historical Stardew Valley almost.
Oh, I would play that so much.
That'd be really good. Yes. I'd be down for that. Imagine, like, I don't know, just making, like, I for some reason I'm thinking of like Italian vineyards and like owning one of those, like in antiquity, making wine or something like that. That would be kind of cool.
Yeah, but, well, again, a game idea that I really don't understand why it doesn't exist yet is a sort of an RPG that is about racing, ancient chariot racing. And basically start off as somebody who wants to be a charioteer, and you know, you have to go from your sort of your mule and your farm cart all the way up to the sort of racing in the Circus Maximus or the Hippodrome at Constantinople, and you know, with the state of the art chariot, because we know so much about ancient charioteers. We've got curses that were cast on them. We know the names of their horses. We know their team colors. We know about all the rivalries. And so there's such a rich game that you could make there, that you know, you would have the racing aspect of it for people who like that kind of thing. You would have the RPG aspect. You'd have the historical antiquity aspect. And why is it always got to be sports cars, you know?
You could totally do something like that and have like the different circuits are like the different, like, so like the top tier circuit would be the chariots, and maybe like the bottom tier circuit would be like farmers and wagons or something like that.
And you can even as a DLC, there are gods that have chariots that race across the sky. You know?
Yeah. And then you have, and I pardon my language here, the fuck history section, where it's just a mishmash of everything that doesn't make sense. You have farmers getting pulled by rabbits. You have chariots getting pulled by, I don't know, gods. I don't know. Like, literally, instead of horses, it's just, you know, Zeus has his teeth around the, or whatever, around the reins.
Well, some Romans had their carts pulled by, their chariots pulled by lions or elephants on special occasions. So, you know, it's all there in the history.
That would be pretty great. So we've talked about a couple of the examples from the book. We've kind of talked about overall just the portrayal of women in antiquity. Now specifically, and I'm sure you've both gotten this question a bunch, which games are more accurate than others? Are there any games that you can reference specifically that have a better portrayal? I'm not saying 100% accurate, but they're the closest that you've seen so far.
I'm going to be difficult and say I'm not sure how helpful the question is. Well, because I mean, there's accuracy and then there's accuracy. And particularly if we're talking about games kind of set in mythological settings. I know when Immortals Phoenix Rising came out, they kept going on about how this was going to be really accurate, but accurate to what? To some made up story of which we have very little records, or, you know, accurate to your belief in this myth, or what kind of accuracy are we talking about here? And if, you know, some of the supernatural female characters that we talk about in the book, for example, you know, what is an accurate depiction of a Medusa? You know, what does this mean in terms of so I think, you know, that's and if we think about kind of accuracy more broadly, there are a lot of games that are kind of accurate in one aspect and then fall down really heavily somewhere else. So, you know, a game might have put a lot of effort into accuracy. I mean, like Assassin's Creed Odyssey put an awful lot of effort into accuracy when it came to the kind of painted colors in the ancient Greek world, which was kind of quite good and quite nice. So when you go up onto the Acropolis, you see all these bright colors and everything, and that's very accurate, but the topology is wrong. And the chronology is also not accurate. So do they get points for accuracy or kind of lose points for accuracy? I'm not sure. You know, it's difficult.
It's almost like you have to break it down into categories of accuracy.
Yeah, it's too difficult. But Jane might have other thoughts.
I really enjoyed the presentation of Hellenistic Egypt in Assassin's Creed Origins. I am loath to praise Ubisoft for anything. But that what they did with that was accurate in some respects, and in other respects, while it wasn't necessarily accurate, it was at least it was giving a sense of something akin to what we can't necessarily recover from the information that we have, but we can get a sense of what this kingdom at this time would have been like. It would have been very multicultural. It would have had many different types of people, of languages, of religions. So although they weren't necessarily presenting it accurately, you know, they were doing something that was sort of adjacent to it, I suppose I should say. But then, of course, by making a big point about how accurate certain aspects of the game are, and by saying we consulted Egyptologists, we consulted archaeologists, experts, etc., that leads people who don't necessarily know any better to think that it's all accurate.
Yeah.
And that is then where we start to see this perpetuation of people believing that because what they have seen is supported by the scholars, then therefore it is accurate in all regards, and that's obviously not true. I mean, personally, I don't like to read novels set in the ancient world. I don't like to watch TV or films set in the ancient world because I find it too much light work. So as far as games are concerned, I would rather play something like Horizon that is doing it, having like a little bit of sort of classical reception sprinkles, I suppose. Than is trying or arguing that it's trying to recreate 100% the ancient world. So, yes, I don't look to games set in the ancient world or reenactments of myths or whatever else. I don't look to them for that. I will study them academically. I won't necessarily play them as a fan.
Whereas I definitely do, but I also just to kind of, I'm afraid, really throw your question out of the window, I really don't care about accuracy. I think, I mean, sometimes the choice not to be accurate, the choice to make a different decision, to play with something different, is the most interesting thing about a game, particularly when it comes to things like issues of gender. So I've been recently playing and working on the new Expeditions game, which allows you to be a kind of legionary commander as a woman. This is nonsense. You couldn't do that. But the game tries to set up a kind of authentic storyline, a storyline that seems like it could be possible in the historical setting for this to happen. And I think, you know, the effort, the engagement with this issue, the thinking about, well, how could it be the case that this situation could arise historically, is much more interesting than whether or not this is, you know, technically true or you know, technically accurate. So I think that kind of the moving around areas of accuracy, the choices made of where to buy into and where to kind of ditch aspects of authenticity, is what I'm most interested in. And I'm interested in the places where they do it creatively. So I am not so fussed by games that have kind of taken some liberties here and there, really.
Yeah, I mean, as I think you said, Kate, earlier on, there are certain things that we know to have been facts as far as antiquity is concerned. So if we take a sort of a military strategy game, we know what armor soldiers were wearing at a particular point in time, because we have the archaeological evidence for that armor. So you can reconstruct the characters and the way that they look. But as far as everything else is concerned, we don't know, because we do not have the sources. So the ancient literature we have that tells us about warfare from generally hindsight. You know, they know that this general was going to win this battle because it had happened historically. So they're just telling you something that already happened. And they're concerned only about the generals, the kings, the emperors, and what these victories say about that particular individual and their trajectory in power. We don't have the information about what the ordinary soldiers were doing or saying or eating or whatever else.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's sort of, there's a lot of space in there to be creative. And yeah, it would be nice to see a little bit more of that and a little bit less of the, well, what would you call it? The sort of, it's like antiquarianism, I suppose. The sort of you know, the 19th century German idea of cataloguing everything, because yes, that's it's great in scholarship because, you know, it's a useful resource, but is it great in entertainment? Not so much, because it doesn't give you any flexibility or any scope to do anything yourself. I mean, in Assassin's Creed Odyssey, the fact that they throw the Peloponnesian War sort of chronology and facts and everything else out the window is I suppose is potentially fun, because you can support whichever side you want in the short term anyway.
Yeah. That's interesting. So based off both of your answers, it kind of just makes me think that you don't mind necessarily seeing the inaccuracies within games, but you would, specifically in the portrayal of women, obviously broaden it because it's very narrowly focused into what the current stereotypes are. But at the same time, you don't necessarily aren't looking for the most historically accurate thing, because you understand entertainment, like it can't always lend itself to that. When you're trying to provide entertainment, it's not always going to lend itself to that level of authenticity. But with that said, to books like the one we've been talking about and other books that you mentioned, another book you had worked on prior, just to bring awareness to the fact that there needs to be more, like there, with this research, you can bring more diversity to video games just by being able to study how games portray not only women but just antiquity in general.
I think you have to be, well, I say have to, you could argue, I suppose, that game developers have no responsibility to anybody. They do not need to provide positive representation because it's really not their problem what the people who are playing or who are not playing their games think about them. They've made a product, that product has been purchased, and people, the purchaser will either enjoy it or not enjoy it, or not care about it or whatever. So there is that question of does it matter, and should game developers care about whether they are portraying any demographic in a positive way? And some people will say no, and some people will say yes, because games are the biggest sector of the entertainment industry. They mm-hmm. make more money than TV, than film, than music, than, you know. And so if you have that much influence, then I think there is this issue of, well, what are you going to do with that influence? And are you going to use it for good or for bad? And that is something to, you know, a game doesn't exist in a vacuum. And I think that's just something to be considered. It doesn't have to be the number one consideration, but it should perhaps be considered, whether that's in relation to women or any other, I say minority. Women are not minority. Women are the majority, but any minority group, how are you portraying them, and is that portrayal justified perhaps?
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I mean, to me, it seems really important to be having the conversations, right? The more these issues are brought out, the more we're talking about them, the more, you know, we publish books on them and do podcasts and kind of engage us as academics with developers and developers with the kind of wider audiences, the more often this comes up, the better. So if we do nothing with it, if we never talk about it, then the chance of any kind of positive progress is non-existent, surely.
And games are constantly being made. Potentially, people who are in the process of scoping a new classical antiquity set game will see our book and will read it. And that will make them think, when they're, you know, storyboarding and everything else, it might make them think about what they were planning to do slightly differently. We won't know that for another sort of 5 years or so, but well, maybe we'll never know it because they'll never tell us. But you know, we will potentially see within the next, the next decade or so, are we going to start seeing more interesting, creative depictions of classical antiquity in video games? And it seems like we might, based on what's coming out now, games that have been in production for a couple of years now. So yeah, hopefully very soon we'll have enough material for volume two.
I think that's a good place to kind of start wrapping up this episode, because we're almost at an hour and a half, and we still have to do the plugs, of course, and everything. So I like to end this show on a handful of different questions. But before we get to those, I just kind of want to give you both one final chance to kind of pitch the book a little bit. Like, what would you like to impart my listeners with about this book?
I think there's a lot for people with all different interests. So I think, you know, if you're not someone who reads a lot of academic classical books, you'll still find plenty in here. There's a lot of engagement with different games that you might have played. There's a lot of talking about, you know, how myth or history relates to some of these games. And because we've got such a range of different writers as well, I think I would encourage people, if you're at all interested in historical or classical games, and preferably if you're interested in women, since that's quite a big theme, then you'll absolutely find, you know, a chapter or something to think about here, I think, because we've aimed for so much range of topics and ideas, there should be something for a really wide audience. So give it a go.
Yeah, I would say the same, really, with perhaps the addition of, you don't even necessarily need to be a gamer. I think if you read novels or watch TV or films, there are a lot of recognizable features that we will be talking about in the volume that you can see the same in the novels that you read set in the ancient world that feature women, that in the TV, in the films, because they are all sort of drawing from each other. The game developers have watched the films, they have watched the TV series, they have read the novels, they have read the graphic novels. So if you have any interest in pop culture at all, that not necessarily just games on their own, I think you will find resonances in here that you will appreciate.
And I think another good point to make about another reason to get this book for my listeners is, so I went to school for video game design, only have an associate's degree. I've realized I like talking about games more than I like making them. It's a lot more entertaining for me. But with that said, one of the lessons my professor taught me, and I think it's very important for prospective game designers, is you need to be well-read. Because when you're well-read, that broadens your horizons. It gives you a lot of different influences to draw from. And this book specifically would be a great way to practice that, to become more well-read, because it's got, like you're saying, it's got a lot of different topics within this very narrow focused of women portrayal in games set in classical history and whatnot. So if listeners you learn anything from this, like game design, you have to be well-read, and this will be a great way to start that journey of becoming more well-read on any topic, let alone just this. So the questions I referenced before, I always like to ask two different questions. One is from another podcast, Alan Alda, the actor from MASH. He has a podcast called Clear and Vivid, and I love his podcast. And he always ends his show with seven quick questions that invite seven quick answers, or that he offers up seven quick answers. I'm not going to ask all seven. I always go with this one because I really enjoy it. And whoever wants to answer first, go for it. What do you wish you really understood?
I really wish I understood that question.
It can mean anything. It could mean, I love hearing answers like this because it's a very open question. Like, what's something, it could be a topic, it could be anything. Like, what do you wish you really understood? I can give you, just as a quick example, for me, I wish I understood music theory. And I wish I really understood, because I love listening to composers and musicians talk about all the different aspects of music theory. It goes right over my head. I don't understand a lick of it, but it's interesting to me. Some other people answered in a more philosophical sense. They wish they understood cruelty. They wish they understood why people are cruel. So this question goes everywhere. So that's why I like to ask it, because it gets people thinking. I know it, and I know I said it invites a quick answer. That's okay. It doesn't have to be a quick answer. Really, for this. I'm not asking seven different questions.
Well, see, Kate actually does understand music theory.
Yeah, so it's not musical theory for me, because I did a full education in musical theory, weirdly. I do feel like I understand musical theory.
She's also an amazing musician, so
I wouldn't go that far. There are loads of little things I could say. Like, at the moment, I'm trying to teach my students a load of literary theory, and there are some approaches that I think, yeah, this makes sense to me, and then there are some things people think that I just do not understand how we got there. I could be kind of so vague as to be useless and just say that, you know, there's a lot about the way other people think that I don't necessarily understand. Like some of the things we've been talking about today. Like, I do not understand why people are so obsessed with having naked Amazons in video games. Why? I mean, and maybe if we all kind of understood each other a bit better, we would have better ways of getting rid of that nonsense. So that's a very vague and non-committal kind of answer. But I think understanding other people's points of view, I think all of us could do to understand that better.
All right. Jane, do you have anything? Or we can pass if you'd like.
Anything I say is going to make me sound like such an idiot.
I know. Some of the other answers I've listened to, it was just something like, I wish I understood how to like make a cabinet. Like, it could be something that Kate brought up, where it's like, I wish I understood people, and I wish we understood each other better. Or it could be something as simple as just like, I just wish I knew how to play a trumpet. Understood how to play trumpet. I don't know, something like that.
Yeah,
I've got a trivial one as well, if you want, Jane. I keep killing all my herbs, so I really wish I understood how to grow herbs and keep them alive. Wouldn't that be good?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, well, the reason that I became an academic in the first place was because I have insatiable curiosity. I'm incredibly nosy, and I like to know everything until I don't, you know. So I think my answer would be probably not the best answer, but I want to know everything. I want to know enough about everything to know that I don't need to know any more about it. So yeah, I would.
That's not a bad answer.
I would happily know everything.
Don't ask for small things over there.
Like I wouldn't just want to learn. I wouldn't just want to know one language. I'd want to know all the languages. You know, I would want to. Since we were talking about music earlier, I can't read music. I am incredibly unmusical, and I would love to be musical and be able to play multiple instruments. You know, it's I'm just greedy. I want it all.
All right. So my last question is what I call questions from Courtney. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba, questions from Courtney. Courtney is my wife, and she doesn't like video games. She's not into all the same things I am, which I actually love about her. It gives me a little bit of a break from my own bullshit. So what I always do is I ask her for questions for my guests, and she doesn't know anything about my guests. She doesn't know what you do or any, and I kind of like that. I like that like separation from everything. So she sent me a list of questions, and I like this one the most. Like, a werewolf turns into a werewolf every full moon. But for you, when a full moon happens, what animal would you turn into?
Well, at the moment, it's the start of the new term, and I'm exhausted, so I'm really tempted to say cat, so I could legitimately sleep for kind of 20 hours for a weekend across the full moon. But I think some kind of bird would be quite good, actually. You know, being able to take a weekend and just go sort of flying over the world and see things from a different perspective, and then, you know, then come back and get on with the rest of life.
Absolutely. I mean, by the same token, I suppose something that swims explore, you know, the Mariana Trench and then just up.
That would be cool. So but you only have a night to do it. Every full moon you turn into some type of like deep diving fish, and you have to get down in there. That would be crazy. You'd have to make sure you're at least in the water every full moon, though. Otherwise, you might that might not be good.
Yes, I suppose being a bird would be easier. Can you just, you know, jump
just
up?
Take off. Oh, my goodness. All right. Well, that is a good place to leave it off. We're turning into birds and fish. So, Jane, Kate, thank you so much for joining me. Where can everybody find you online? And besides the book, is there anything else you'd like to promote?
We are both on Twitter. And we talk about all manner of things, including games, on Twitter. We have university web pages if you want to know more about the academic side of our work.
What are your Twitter handles?
I'm at JL Draycott.
I'm at Kate EXE, so it is KAT and then EXE, like an executable, which shows quite how long I've been playing games. Really, that I thought that was a good Twitter handle.
I've always read your Twitter handle as CatX.
I understood the EXE reference. It made me think about it. For me, as usual, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at StillLoadingPod on all of them. If you want to email me, you can email me stillloadingcontact@gmail.com. If you want to support the show, you can do so in a number of ways. You can give it a 5-star rating or review on Apple Podcasts or whichever podcasting app you use, because that helps more people find the show, and it makes me feel warm and fuzzy, and I like feeling warm and fuzzy. And if you want to support the show monetarily, you can go to patreon.com/stillloadingpod. For $1 a month, you'll get all the episodes early at a higher bitrate, as well as access to a patron-exclusive Discord. I actually just created a new tier, so some of the episodes that are coming out after this won't even have this section to it. There's a $4 tier where you get 2 mini bonus episodes every month, and there's a $5 tier that includes everything prior, as well as an exclusive monthly podcast called Still Bonding, where my friend Eric and I go through all of the James Bond movies and discuss their wackiness and insanity that goes along with that series. So if that interests you, patreon.com/stillloadingpod. But of course, the most important shout out is the Bit by Bit Foundation. The Bit by Bit Foundation is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to put video games and video game consoles in the hands of kids receiving inpatient care at hospitals. So if you want to support them, go to bitbybitfoundation.org and consider donating. And that will do it for this episode of Still Loading. Kate, Jane, thank you once again for joining me.
Thank you for having us.
And I will see you all next time.